Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on pain management.
So good morning, and thank you for having me here to talk about methadone today. So today, I think one of the key points you're going to get from our talk today is you're going to walk away feeling like, okay, methadone is a really effective analgesic, and I got to be honest with you, I'm not sure what we would do without methadone. There are times that I don't think we could get people under control pain-wise without methadone, so it's extremely effective, but it requires significant expertise in using it. It does have some significant dangers, and so we're going to talk through some of those, and hopefully you'll feel like you've got some knowledge base, but then of course you're going to be building that with your practice as well. We're going to talk about the risks and the benefits of using methadone for, and we're going to focus specifically on methadone for pain management. And we're going to talk about some of the different ways to convert to methadone from oral morphine equivalents. And hopefully when we go through a case, you'll be able to do that. So number one, let's talk about, what do you guys know about methadone, right? So you guys may have talked about some of this already, but when you think about methadone, what are some mechanisms of action that come to mind? Anybody? Feel free to shout them out.
NMDA.
Good, good. So NMDA antagonism. Okay. What else?
Mu receptors.
Yes. So mu receptor what?
Agonist?
Yes, exactly. Mu receptor agonist. Okay. Anything else? This is one that not everybody thinks about. I think we talk about the NMDA antagonism a lot, but we don't talk about that it's actually a serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor as well. So it's not as strong as some of the agents that we use specifically for serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibition, but it is significant enough that we can see serotonin toxicity from methadone. So it is significant. So why is this mechanism important, and why is it significant to understand that it has all of these mechanisms? So does anybody, when we talk about a mu receptor agonist, what do mu receptor agonists do? These are our opioids, right? So the opioid class in general, this is their mechanism. So what do opioids do for pain? How do they work? Mu receptor agonists, but what does that mean? Have you thought about that before? Kind of, sort of, not really. Just kind of say, okay, that works for me. I know what it says, but not necessarily what that means. Okay. Anybody have a good feel for that? Or do you want me to just tell you? Okay, so we'll do a little teaching here. So when we think about mu receptor agonists for pain specifically, the biggest piece of it that helps with pain is in the dorsal horn, so in the spinal cord, all right? So what happens is that actually if you have like a presynaptic neuron. So if we have a presynaptic neuron, we'll just say it looks something like this. So most opioid receptors, most mu opioid receptors are actually on a presynaptic neuron, all right? And then if you have the postsynaptic neuron, there are a few there. So our mu agonists, what they do is they help with feedback mostly. And what they do is these are mostly glutamate releasing neurons, which if you remember, glutamate stimulates nerves, right? So what happens is mu receptors, when they are triggered, they actually help hyperpolarize the cell. They help to bring it to a negative charge. So they make it so that this cell is not as likely to release glutamate, all right? So that's helpful because it calms down the pain signal, right? Well, there are also some over here, but what's interesting is that, so like I said, the majority are presynaptic, there are some postsynaptic, but when you talk about these neurons, also when you talk about glutamate, when it actually does get released, it comes over and it stimulates, if you remember, the AMPA and the NMDA receptors, okay? So NMDA more with chronic pain, so it has to be triggered and all that fun stuff. But anyway, the NMDA receptor allows calcium in when it's agonized and then propagates the signal, okay? So if you have something that can be a mu opioid agonist and an NMDA antagonist at the same time, those are working together. And what's interesting too is when you have, if glutamate gets over to stimulate this NMDA receptor, it causes a whole cascade of issues. And this is where we think actually some of the hyperalgesia and things come from a chronic pain syndrome, is this calcium then triggers back the release of all kinds of pain promoting neurotransmitters or neurokinin. So by blocking an opioid receptor and an NMDA receptor, you're probably helping to squelch some of that that wind up phenomenon, right? So it's significant. And then we also know that SNRIs or norepinephrine specifically also helps with pain control, right? So you've got really two mechanisms that are working synergistically together, plus another mechanism for pain that's coming in to help. So we see methadone being helpful for patients that really other opioids aren't necessarily helpful for. So again, it's a mu opioid agonist, an NMDA receptor antagonist, and we see some serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibition. Any questions about that? Okay. So we do see methadone used for medication-assisted therapy for addiction. There are specific laws that regarding prescription of methadone for those patients, and actually laws regarding dispensing from the pharmacy too. So you have to be specially licensed for both. So you can see some stigma around methadone related to that. But when it comes to using methadone for analgesia, which it isn't actually FDA indicated for, but we use it off-label, then we see that there aren't those same laws that apply. So you don't need that special DEA number to prescribe methadone for pain. I do suggest that you put for pain on the prescription when you're writing that, so that the pharmacy that's dispensing knows that they don't need the special license to dispense it for that situation. It's available in all kinds of dosage forms, tablet-wise, which we can use orally. Sometimes they're used rectally, and you can crush the tablets and use them buccally or this oral solution. It comes as a 5-milligram tablet, a 10-milligram tablet, and it also comes as a 40-milligram tablet that you can dissolve in water. But those 40-milligram tablets, about 10 years ago, they got restricted to methadone maintenance, because what was happening was people felt like, oh, there's a 40-milligram tablet, that must be kind of maximum dose. So some people were using it for pain management and not recognizing how big of a dose that was with methadone. So they pulled back on that. So those are restricted to utilization for methadone maintenance therapy for addiction. Also available as solutions, 1 milligram per ml, 2 milligrams per ml, and 10 milligrams per ml. What's nice about that is you can do some very concentrated solution for patients, but also with those, when you need a really small dose of methadone, you can get there with the oral solution. So you can do 1.5 milligrams or 2.5 milligrams, and you can do that easily, particularly with the solutions. You can also give methadone IV or sub-Q. If you use it IV push, does anybody know what the big side effect is if you use methadone IV push? Why we don't use methadone IV push typically? What is the side effect you think about with methadone that's kind of special? Arrhythmias, yeah, so QT prolongation. So actually, if you give methadone IV push, you increase that risk. So we don't typically give methadone IV push. But you can give it IV or sub-Q. You can give it IV piggyback, and you can give it sub-Q. There have been reports of some irritation, like if you use a butterfly and use the same area for several days with methadone, you can get some sub-Q irritation. But also, if you just, once the patient starts to get some irritation in that site, if you just give about 1 milligram of dex into the same site, that helps with that irritation. So you can give methadone subcutaneously, which we utilize a lot for hospice patients. As far as its pharmacokinetics, it's a pretty special opioid. It's very, very lipophilic. Its oral bioavailability varies significantly, anywhere from 36% to even some patients absorb about 100% of the methadone that you give them. So really IV would be essentially equal to PO in those patients. On average, patients absorb about 70%, which is really good for an opioid. And actually almost all of the absorption happens in the stomach, which is different than other opioids and can be really nice for patients who have like a high obstruction. So if you've got a patient with a tumor obstruction, you can use methadone orally and they still will absorb the majority of it. Your peak plasma concentrations happen at about 2.5 to 4 hours with single doses. Metabolism-wise, it's primarily metabolized through CYP3A4 and 2B6, which is different. It's not not many agents are primarily metabolized through 2B6. That's a different one. But it also does go through 2C8, 2C9, 2C19, 2D6. When you hear all those, what do you think? Yes, this is a nightmare for drug interactions. So you have a ton of opportunity for inhibiting or inducing the metabolism of methadone. On the other hand, it also helps from the standpoint of you have a lot of ways you can get rid of methadone. So if you start to lose some of this enzyme activity or if you have some drug interactions, then in some ways it can go through some other routes to get rid of it. It's metabolized almost completely to inactive metabolites, which is nice. Then those inactive metabolites are eliminated actually primarily through the feces, again, different than most opioids, and a small percentage through the urine. Very, very little is excreted unchanged. It's almost completely as metabolites. But this is the other thing that's really interesting about methadone, right, is its half-life. So its half-life can range anywhere from 5 to 130 hours. Now, interestingly, methadone is kind of a biphasic agent, so that's how it gets to be so long. But there are patients that, you know, it's taking days to even have half-life. Do you guys remember how many half-lives it takes to get to steady state?
About five.
What does steady state mean? Remember?
Serum concentration is consistent.
Yeah, the serum concentration is consistent. So you're giving a dose on a scheduled basis. You give it over and over and over again, and then you finally get to the point that the serum concentration stays the same, right? You're no longer building that amount. So it takes about 5 half-lives to get to where your serum concentration is now, where you've essentially got the maximum out of it of what you're going to get, right? So again, we have that with single doses, you're talking about you get your maximum at 2.5 to 4 hours. With repeated doses, it's going to take 5 half-lives. If a patient's half-life is 130 hours, how long is it going to take you to get to steady state with those patients? How long is 130 hours in days? It's about a little over 5 days, right? So 5 times 5, you're talking 25 days. You're talking close to a month before that patient gets to steady state. So this is what happens with methadone is, you know, we come and we evaluate someone after the first day and they look pretty good, right? But the problem is they're going to continue to build that methadone up in their system over and over and over again. Some patients, it may only take 2 to 3 days to get to their steady state because their half-life may be relatively short. Some patients, it may take close to a month to get to their steady state. So it's a bit unpredictable from that standpoint, and what I would say is it just requires a ton of monitoring with these patients to know what's going to happen with them. But again, noting the peak analgesia and the side effects may not happen for 10 to 30 days. We typically say you don't want to make dosage changes more frequently than every 3 to 5 days because no patient's really going to be at their maximum until that point. But really that 7 to 10 day mark is really even more ideal if you're worried about a patient that they're continuing to accumulate. Side effects of methadone. It has some side effects that are pretty similar to other opioids. You can get sedation with it. You can get nausea. You can get delirium. If you give too much of it, you're going to get respiratory depression, just like other opioids. You do get some constipation, although the constipation tends to be a little bit less with methadone than it does with some of the other agents, probably a lot because of its combined mechanisms to where you don't need quite as much. That's probably the biggest reason. You can get serotonin toxicity, which is why? Because of what mechanism? Yeah, it's an SNRI, so it's a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And then also the other kind of special thing is that QT interval prolongation. So I've given you a little bit of background information here. So now, and drawing upon what you've probably already done in patient care, I want to talk through what you guys see as the benefits of methadone and kind of put them up here and think about the types of patients you would think about methadone in, and again, just why this over another opioid. So let's think about benefits. So someone give me one benefit they can think about. And it may be things we've already talked about, or it may be things that are different. So
long acting, that's a liquid, you can go through a J-tube and a G-tube.
Good. So it's inherently long acting, right? So unlike our other long acting agents that are formulated to be long acting, this one's long acting in and of itself. So I think that's two of them. So it's crushable, so you can crush the tablets and it's still long acting, or you can give it through a PEG or any other type of interoral access and it's still long acting, or even the IV and sub-Q forms are still long acting. So you're not having to give something every 4 hours if the patient can't swallow a whole pill. You can still give maybe Q12 hour or Q8 hour dosing with this drug. So it's really nice for people who can't swallow whole pills. Okay, good. What else?
Good for neuropathic pain.
Absolutely. So we gain some benefit. Do you know why we think it's better for neuropathic pain than what is it?
The mu receptor.
So all of our opioids hit the mu receptor and help. Can all help with neuropathic pain to some extent. And we think about methadone as maybe adding a little bit more for neuropathic pain. Why is that? Yeah, probably related to that NMDA receptor.
And
SNRI, exactly. Yeah, so maybe that SNRI, because we think about SNRIs, TCAs are SNRIs, right? So our tricyclic antidepressants are SNRIs, and they help with neuropathic pain. All right, what else?
Smaller doses.
What do you mean by that? Smaller doses.
People who are on thousands of OMEs a day, it's very difficult, even with long acting, to get them at what they need. And
great.
That translates into a much more manageable dose.
Great. So smaller doses, meaning that people who needed thousands of oral morphine equivalents, we sometimes can convert them to methadone at a few pills a day, right? That we really couldn't do with any other long acting. So I would say it's so potent. So its potency, and again, probably a lot of that, again, comes back to this NMDA receptor antagonism that is probably squelching some of that, maybe even opioid-induced hyperalgesia that we got from those thousands of oral morphine equivalents, or it's just helping with the underlying pain syndrome in a way that the other agents weren't. So its potency is really unmatched. Right. What else?
Low cost?
Yes, that's a great one. So cost-wise, it's pretty cheap. All right. Any concept of how cheap? If we had to compare it to, let's say, like long-acting morphine, which is probably one of our cheapest long-actings, right? So we tend to think of that as on most formularies, hospice preferred. How would methadone compare to that? If would you say it's half as much, a third as much, a tenth? What would you think?
Tenth.
It's about a tenth, yeah. It's about a tenth of what even long-acting morphine is. And depending on the pharmacy and the markup, sometimes even less than that. Okay, but cost is a big one.
Can be used as a co-analgesic.
Oh, good. So thank you for bringing that up. He said it can be used as a co-analgesic. What do you mean by that?
Because of this antagonism of the NMDA, it helps potentiate the effectiveness of the other opioids.
Absolutely. And so he said that because of the NMDA, it can help potentiate the activity of other opioids. So we're actually seeing quite a bit written about this right now with related to adding somewhat low doses of methadone to other even high dose opioid regimens to try and grab hold of some of that NMDA antagonism and maybe keep the doses of methadone low, help decrease some of your side effects, but help with the other issues that we see too. Great.
In that way, doesn't it help decrease tolerance?
And does it decrease tolerance? It can. It can help decrease tolerance because we do think that the glutamate activity has something to do with tolerance too and feedback to downregulating some of those opioid receptors and stuff. Yes, we do think it probably does help with reducing tolerance development as well. Absolutely. Let's look at this and see if we missed any. I think you guys got most of them. Oh, so a couple here. So decreased neurotoxicity. So have you guys talked about opioid-induced neurotoxicity at all? Okay, so opioid-induced neurotoxicity is where we see that we think of opioids as CNS depressants, generally, but what we can see happen when you give either moderate doses of opioids for long periods of time or high doses of opioids even for short periods of time, the metabolites themselves can build up in a way that it actually starts stimulating the central nervous system. We can see myoclonus, we can see delirium, we can see seizures actually if we don't treat it quickly enough. So this all comes primarily from metabolites, and what we see is that because methadone has inactive metabolites, it's really pretty low on the toxicity scale. And so the decreased opioid-induced neurotoxicity is big. That is sometimes the whole reason that we convert people to methadone or add methadone on, is because we start seeing some of these signs of neurotoxicity. Also, the fact that it has multiple metabolic processes can actually be somewhat of a benefit, like I mentioned. It can be a problem because it can have lots of drug interactions, but it can also be a benefit from the standpoint that if you give an inhibitor, then it may be able to just go through another avenue. And as we'll talk about later, it can actually make it more feasible to use it in hepatic and renal failure patients in a way that they still are able to get rid of it. And so we'll talk about that in the hepatic and renal failure one. So its metabolic profile is actually helpful. Okay. So this is a chart of the cost. And so you can see here, if we use morphine immediate release tabs as an example of the reference point, so it being 1.0, you can see that even if you use morphine immediate release tabs, which are really the cheapest immediate release opioid out there, and scheduled that around the clock instead of using the long-acting morphine, methadone is still a third of that cost. So it's still significantly cheaper. And if you compare that to morphine extended release tabs, you can see here you got 0.3 to about 6.5. So it's a huge difference. So we see people that just simply can't afford, if they have no insurance and they're a cash paying patient, even those patients usually can't even afford to pay for short acting morphine around the clock. So methadone is often a really good option for them. Yes.
The morphine oral solution.
The morphine oral solution is not on here, but it is significantly more expensive. It's cheaper than, it would be cheaper than like the extended release oxycodone tablets, but like our morphine solution that we pay for in our hospital, we pay about $2 for every 20 milligrams. So it's significant. It's a significant cost.
So it would be better to crush, dissolve, and
give. Yeah, it is definitely, it's always cheaper to use tablets and crush it and dissolve it than it is to use the solution. There are times with certain brands that you can get something that's only about 50% or maybe twice as much as the morphine tablets, but it really depends on the manufacturer. But the concentrated solutions are almost always more expensive than tablets. And you can see that even here with the methadone oral solution. Methadone oral solution, you can see, is multiple fold more expensive than the tablets. So tablets are always cheaper. And the nice thing with methadone tablets is there is a generic that you can get in the U.S. at least that you can dissolve in water. So even not even just the 40 milligram tablets, but the smaller ones, you can put them in water and dissolve them. So they're really easy to dissolve for patients. It just really becomes more about volume. Can the patient use a full 5 or 10 mLs volume, or do they need that 0.5 mLs? So that's where it gets a little more, where you rely a little more on the concentrated solutions. All right, so we've talked about the benefits, and to me, this is like why I could never replace methadone with anything unless we maybe synthesize something else. But the problem is the risks, right? Because otherwise, we would use this in pretty much every patient. So if we think about risks, or maybe not even risks, but maybe just things you want to consider before you would start it. What are some things you guys think about? Again, things maybe we've already talked about, or things that you maybe could draw up on from other experiences. QT prolongation. That's almost always one that practitioners are very, very concerned about. Okay? What else? Respiratory depression. And we do see there are some reports or some considerations that maybe there is some more respiratory depression or even apnea issues with methadone. But we can have respiratory depression with every opioid, but there are maybe some particular precautions with patients who have respiratory issues already. Potentially. Again, it doesn't usually limit us. We use methadone in our COPD patients and stage. So with caution, you can do it. Okay? What else? Drug-drug interactions. Good. What else?
Because it is long-acting.
Exactly. So some of its benefits, including its duration of action, can be a major issue. So it's very long acting. And with that, not only is it very long acting, but it's so variable, right? Some patients it is, some patients it's shorter. And we see this as somewhat of a significant issue, particularly if patients abuse methadone, because what we see happen is they take a whole bunch of methadone, and by the time they feel it, if they're looking for that feeling, sometimes it's too late, and you've got so much methadone on board that it's a major issue. So I tend to try to avoid methadone in patients that I think are not trustworthy patients, that are not reliable, to take the medication the way that you prescribe it to them. Okay, yeah, so its long-acting nature can be very, very helpful. What else? How comfortable are you guys converting to methadone, like today? If you're comfortable, raise your hand. Okay, I see no hands. Okay, I see one Asi. Okay, and how many of you are comfortable converting from oxycodone to morphine? Okay, I see lots of hands. Why? Why are you comfortable converting between those two, but maybe not to methadone?
Multiple scales of conversion.
Yes, so the multiple scales of conversion. So there is a lot of controversy that surrounds conversion to methadone. And not even so much controversy as there are so many published ways to do it. So if you go try to learn how to convert to methadone yourself without some sort of guidance, it's like, I give up, because you find literally there are over 40 published protocols right now to convert to methadone. And usually if you talk to somebody who's been doing it for a long time, they're like, yeah, I use this one, but then I tweak this a little bit. And so beyond the published protocols, there are probably hundreds of ways out there to convert to methadone, and there have been some reviews that show that none of them are really superior to another. They're all usable. So it really comes down to you have to find a way to do it, get some mentorship in doing it, and stick with that one, because once you learn to use that one, then you can get comfortable with it, and it probably will be effective within your practice. Okay, so yes, there's controversy in conversion. Anything else you guys can think of? Risks or even considerations with prescribing methadone?
Diversion.
Diversion issues. And I would say some of that diversion comes from the fact that there are so few methadone maintenance programs out there, that there are so many people seeking methadone. So I would say that all kind of goes together in that the fact that it is used for addiction brings in some issues. One, from the diversion standpoint, but two, even just from the stigma related to it, right? So sometimes patients just simply won't take it. And then sometimes they go to the pharmacy and pharmacies won't carry it. So access can sometimes be an issue. And there can be some misconception or misperception about who can prescribe it and who can dispense it because of those laws related to addiction and medication-assisted therapy. So
outpatient prescribing, too.
Outpatient prescribing, yeah, yeah.
It's hard to get somebody on.
Yes.
And then get somebody to pick it up.
Absolutely. So access both from a prescriber and from a pharmacy standpoint. So access prescription-wise and dispensing-wise can both be serious considerations. And we think about this a lot, particularly when we're sending people to rural areas. It's something you have to think about. So if you've got somebody inpatient and you're thinking about starting methadone, you really should ensure that that can be continued when they leave before you think about it. Good. All right. Let's see if we missed any here. So it's potency, so it's long-acting nature. The fact that accumulation can lead to overdose before we even knew what was happening. Drug interactions, QT prolongation, and then we came up with a few more there. So, good. Any questions about any of that? Okay, let's go into a little more detail with some of that. So with methadone and QT prolongation, I wanted to talk about this a little bit because I do think that some patients don't have access to methadone related to the fact that we're maybe a little bit hyper alert with the QT prolongation with methadone. When we see clinically significant QT prolongation, meaning a QTC over 500 milliseconds, that really in the literature is almost most consistently associated with methadone doses over 100 milligrams a day. The vast majority of our patients are not on that high of a dose and can utilize much, much smaller doses. But that's where we see the highest incidence of clinically significant QT prolongation. When we look at the FDA reports that are out there, the lowest dose that's been associated with QT prolongation that didn't seem to have other provoking factors was about 29 milligrams a day. And the lowest dose associated with Torsades was 65 milligrams a day. Now, I will tell you, I have actually only had one patient that I think maybe had arrhythmia related to methadone, had syncope, but we have a ton of patients all the time with clinically significant QT prolongation on methadone. So we do see it a lot. There was an article written in 2009 that was a group of providers, both from addiction and pain management, that came together to say, okay, what do we need to do from the standpoint of methadone to determine how we want to approach this? So they came up with this really comprehensive plan about that they, and this article is worth reading, but that they wanted providers to disclose this risk to patients. They wanted a significant clinical history to be gathered, including if the patient had any family history of sudden cardiac death, if they had any history of syncope, all those things to think about whether to utilize methadone or not. The really controversial thing that this group had recommended are screening electrocardiograms. So what they recommended was that patients should have a baseline ECG prior to getting methadone, They should have one at steady state, which they suggested within 30 days, and then they should have one at least annually thereafter, and with any significant dosage changes, you should essentially start this again. So that seems very prudent and very on top of things, but there was a lot of backlash, both from the addiction community and the pain community, because just being able to keep up with this from a cost standpoint for methadone maintenance was really not feasible. And then also from a pain standpoint, trying to balance this risk benefit of, again, if you can't get somebody under control with anything else, is it worth the risk? So they suggested some risk stratification and then also a drug interaction screen to make sure that some of the drug interaction issues were going to be addressed. So where are we at this point, and what would I recommend in palliative care? Well, there's really only one article out there that helps guide in this specific population, and the doses that they looked at were pretty small. We just did a review in the last year that we will look at, that we actually found much higher incidence of QT prolongation than what is published out there, because our doses, I think, tend to be a bit higher. What I want you to think about with QT prolongation, when you're thinking about the risk benefit of methadone and QT prolongation, is number one, the relative risk versus the absolute risk. So if somebody has a QTC over 500, how does that change their risk of torsades? Because that's our real issue, right? It's not about the QT prolongation. Our concern is this patient going to have torsades? So how much does their risk of torsades go up when they go over 500? Do you guys know? Take a guess. So five times. It's actually a fourfold increase. So you see about a fourfold increase, and that has been established in patients with more like congenital long QT syndrome. So we really actually don't know in drug-induced, but that's what we think. So about a fourfold increase. So that feels like a lot, right? So then the question, because that feels scary, is, all right, then what's the absolute risk? So if the patient is less than 500, what's the risk of torsades? Because then we know it goes up fourfold, but we got to know what is it to begin with to know if it goes up fourfold, how significant is that? So if your risk, if you're like 450 to 500, what's your risk of torsades? How many of you would guess it's less than 5%? Okay, less than 5%. How many of you would guess it's less than 1%? Okay, got a couple. How many of you would guess it, so it is less than 1%. How many of you would guess it's less than 0.5%? Okay, one person. All right, so it's actually like 0.02% to 0.2%. So it's really small. So when you're talking about going from that small of a risk to fourfold, more than that, that fourfold feels like a lot, and that's per year. So it's like at the high end, 0.2% per year of patients will develop torsades that have that QT, that have a QT over, that's really, so you're talking 0.8% in patients that are over 500 per year, all right? So if we think about this, and we have a patient who's going to live 3 to 6 months, all right? You want to put them on methadone, but their QTC is 540, right? And you say, I'm not going to put them on methadone because their QTC is 540. So if we think about that, and we think about that this patient's risk is 0.8% per year, we think they're going to live about 3 to 6 months. Their risk is probably about 0.4%. So again, these are numbers that we're playing with. But if you have a patient, sometimes I look at this patient and I think, what's the risk this patient's going to develop torsades? Probably less than 1%. What's the risk of this patient's going to be in really severe pain if we don't use methadone? Probably about 100%. So if you have those patients that you're like, you know what, there's no way that we're going to get them out of the hospital if we don't use methadone, despite the fact that their QTC is over 500, then I personally say stop checking the QTC, because you shouldn't do anything with it. The best therapy for that patient is the methadone. To me, I think that's where informed consent is significant. You talk to the patient about that. We know your risk here, but I also am concerned that we aren't going to be able to control your pain without this agent. I think this agent would be helpful. And that may also be where methadone as a co-analgesic can be extremely helpful. So bringing it on board with the other opioids to get some of the benefits, but keeping your doses low, under 100 milligrams and maybe even under 60 milligrams. Definitely if you can keep it under 30 milligrams, your risk is really low. Right? Okay, so thinking about the absolute risk, thinking about prognosis, and thinking about the risk versus benefit, really important in our patient population. It's very different than a patient who's 20 years old with congenital long QT that's going to live 40 years and has a 0.8% per year risk, right? So it's a very, very different risk benefit discussion. So one of the other risks, so the controversies in methadone conversion. So again, there are about 40 published protocols, but within those protocols, there's a ton of variability even within those. I'm just going to give you three protocols today that are published that are really, really common, but I want to tell you what are some of the key components that if you look at those protocols out there, what are going to be very different within them. So one of the things that varies within the published protocols is the dosage conversion ratio. So in some of the conversion ratios, they're fixed. In some, they're variable. What does that mean? Has anybody looked at a lot of these? What does that mean? A fixed ratio versus a variable ratio. Any thoughts?
Well, fixed means as you go up in dose of the one drug, you can go up linearly.
Yes.
In the other drug. Variable is with methadone, as you go up in the dose, you have to change your conversion ratio.
Great. So his point was that fixed would mean that it's a linear relationship, right? So as you go up in one, it's the same. So this would be similar to, again, if we accept that 10 milligrams of PO morphine is equal to about, I shouldn't have done that. So 30 milligrams of PO morphine, I had to do a calculation there, I'll back up. 30 milligrams of PO morphine is equal to about 20 milligrams of oxycodone. Then 60 is equal to 40 and 90 is equal to 60. So it's a linear relationship, a fixed relationship. With methadone, it's most published protocols out there show that it's variable, right? So somebody who's on 1,000 oral morphine equivalents is much, much more sensitive to methadone than someone who's on 100 oral morphine equivalents before you convert them. So there are a number of theories as to why that is. I think it's probably a lot to do with the mechanism. And the patients who are on higher doses probably have more of that wind up, probably have more of that opioid-induced neurotoxicity, and more tolerance. So adding this on and the synergy that you get from the NMDA antagonism is probably more significant for those patients than others. It's clear to me when I read these studies that it should be a variable ratio. Okay, I worked with a fixed ratio for a number of years. I would say I had much more sedation with those patients. And when you look at the protocols that have a fixed ratio that found that the relationship was linear, their patient population was very narrow. So they maybe had patients who were all on less than 100 oral morphine equivalents, so they of course would find a linear or find a fixed variable because their patients were all the same. Okay, so I would say just caution with that. If you're thinking about using a fixed ratio, I would recommend highly that it's variable. Yes?
Do you feel like you need to maybe switch paths if they're on already an NMDA or an SNMD separately? You know what I mean? Like outside of the opiates.
Great question. So the question was, if they're already on an NMDA antagonist or an SNRI, do you need to think about that, and would that change your conversion thoughts? Is that accurate?
Yeah.
So I have considered that before. We've had patients that we've converted from high-dose opioids on a ketamine infusion from their high-dose opioids over to methadone. And I will say that we still saw significant benefit from the methadone. The big consideration I would have if someone was on an SNRI is serotonin toxicity. Exactly. So if they were on a duloxetine and methadone combination, I would be thinking about serotonin toxicity. I'd be watching for that. And then often patients are on something else too that would be serotonergic. So that would be my biggest concern. I don't typically change my ratios or my thought process that much with a conversion over to methadone if they're already on those agents. Sometimes I question whether we're going to get that much more from methadone, particularly if they're on a ketamine infusion or even oral ketamine. But I have seen that patients have. So I have a number, a few patients, actually a handful of patients, that that combination has been really great for them. So no, I don't typically change my thought process that much. The maintenance interval, when you look at different conversion protocols, will look a little bit different. Some will recommend 6 hours, some every 8 hours, some every 12 hours, some every 24. I will tell you, it's very, very difficult to get 24 hours of analgesia out of methadone. We use it in methadone maintenance every 24 hours because it sticks around long enough to prevent withdrawal, but our analgesic benefit is significantly shorter than the half-life. There, again, are a number of theories as to why that is. Maybe it's because it's a biphasic drug, but typically patients can get 8 or 12 hours out of methadone, so that's almost always what you're going to see. There will be some patients that you may see in clinic or you may see in the hospital, particularly with initial conversion, that maybe need every 6 hours, but that I would say is like less than 5% of people. Almost everybody can get 8 or 12 hours out of it. The 24-hour people for me are usually those people who like only have pain at night, and so you give them some at bedtime, or particularly have trouble in the first part of the day or something. So usually you're only looking for 6 or 8 hours of coverage when you're doing that. Another one of the big controversies is, what do you do with the other opioid? So for example, if you're converting somebody from long-acting morphine to methadone, how do you get them to methadone? Because if you think about it, when you're doing your conversion and you're looking at where your methadone is going to end up. So, okay, let's say the patient was on, like, let's say MS-Contin 60Q8, all right? So we do a conversion to methadone. And so this is where they are at their steady state with the long-acting morphine. And to get to that analgesia with methadone, we do a calculation, but our calculation is going to give us what methadone is going to look like at maybe 5 to 7 days, right? So over that 5 days, the patient's gonna do that buildup that we talked about, right? So they're gonna get somewhat there by about 5 days, right? So the question is, what do you do with all this pain in the short term? So there are some protocols out there that would taper off of this long-acting morphine, and some that would say that would be what are called stop and start or stop and go protocols, where they would say stop the long-acting and start the methadone here. I will tell you, I have become a pretty firm believer in stop and go. I have been burnt several times by trying to taper somebody off of their long-acting because the patient was maybe way more sensitive to the methadone than what we anticipated they were going to be. Because I tend to want to taper people off that are in really horrible pain, so then we tend to be a little more aggressive with their methadone. And so I've been burnt a few times by people getting significantly oversedated, and when you're using a long-acting, then you're stuck with both for 8 or 12 hours. So I am a firm believer in stop and go, and just making sure that when you start the methadone that you have plenty of PRN to cover that, and then the patient can taper off their PRN as they're going. You guys may also at some point work with Dr. Ferris to do kind of a graduated initiation of methadone along with a taper of the long acting, but I'll tell you, most clinicians are stop and go people at this point. And speaking from experience, I'm a stop-and-go person. So. And then there, some protocols actually use methadone PRN. How many of you have ever used methadone PRN? Yeah, it's not that common, but if you read some of the published protocols out there, they'll actually recommend using methadone PRN, especially in the initiation phase, to try and figure out how much somebody needs. Almost always we're using a different immediate release opioid as the PRN, and some of that has to do with just utilizing the agents together and getting the benefit from both of them. And the only time we really ever use methadone PRN is if it's a cost related issue. So if somebody can't even afford the immediate release morphine. So when we talk about, so again, I'll give you three protocols here that are out there that are relatively frequently referred to. This is from the EPIRC Fast Fact, number 75. So this is the methadone EPIRC Fast Fact. And you can see here what I'm talking about with the variable ratio, that if the patient is on less than 100 oral morphine equivalents per day before you convert them, your ratio is only 3-1. As compared to if they're on 900 oral morphine equivalents per day, your ratio becomes 15-1. Right? So very, very different. This is actually what Ohio Health uses. This is their protocol. Then the Fast Fact would recommend that once you do that conversion, similar to what we would recommend with other opioids, you decrease by 25-50%, thinking about all the different patient-related factors, how their pain is controlled, are they sedated, all of those things prior to conversion. Then you would decrease for your final dose. Oops. There is one protocol that uses this exact same variable ratio that actually recommends not decreasing for cross tolerance and actually considering increasing a little bit for a methadone bolus. So again, this is where things get confusing. This is another way you'll see when you start looking at methadone protocols out there that they vary is, what do you do with the number once you get the number? It varies all over the place. So again, EPIRC Fast Fact would recommend decreasing just like you typically would for most protocols. There's one protocol out there that I want to point out because it's so different, and there are still some people utilizing it, although I am a pretty firm believer in not using this protocol. So it's the UK method, or a lot of people call it the Morley-Macon method because those were the authors on the original article. They use a stop-start method, so they would stop the opioid that they're converting from and start methadone. And what they do is they use a fixed ratio of 10-1 for morphine to methadone. So for every 10 milligrams of morphine, it's 1 milligram of methadone. And you would use a maximum of 30 milligrams of methadone. So if the patient's on 500 oral morphine equivalents, you would use 30 milligrams as your dose. If they're on 100 oral morphine equivalents, you would use 10 milligrams as your methadone dose. Then you use that every 3 hours PRN pain, all right? That's where it gets scary because, like I talked about, number one, 30 milligrams of methadone is a big dose of methadone. Number two, then you're talking about the patient could actually maybe get 240 milligrams of methadone in that day. So that's what's a little bit scary. So then what they would do is they would give this Q3 hours PRN to a patient over a few days. Then on day six, they would look at days 4 and 5 or days 5 and 6, wherever you're at with that. So over the previous 48 hours, you would average the use of the 24-hour use and say, okay, so maybe this patient took 90 milligrams per 24 hours. You would divide that over a 12-hour dose and give them 45 Q12. One of the issues that people fall into with this is, again, the PRN pain issue. My problem with this is if you have a patient who was, prior to conversion to methadone, using their opioids for anxiety or depression or to get high, and then you give them methadone PRN with a possible dose of 240, you can get burnt really quickly from the fact that, again, they take a whole bunch of methadone, and by the time they feel it, they've got so much methadone on board that you're in trouble. So I highly do not recommend this method. Again, you will see some practitioners out there still using it. That's why I don't recommend it, is because of that patient population that you maybe don't know what's going on with them and why they're using it. But you can get in the danger zone really quickly. This is actually the protocol that we use at OSU. It's been studied in a couple of different studies that you can see here. So it's a little bit simplified as far as the number of variation, the number of variables that we use. So it's a 4-8-12, and pretty much all of them use a 2-1 ratio from oral methadone to IV methadone. But this one also we would recommend converting and using the 25-50% reduction after, which wasn't actually recommended in these initial articles. But in these initial articles, every patient was very uniform, converted from morphine. So again, in the real world, we would recommend a 25-50% reduction. So I wanted to walk through just a couple of numbers with you. I don't know if you guys have calculators or calculators on your phone, but if you can think through a couple of examples with me, just to think about how these work. And that's why I gave you the numbers in front of you so that you can look at these. So let's first convert somebody who is on, let's say, 1,200 oral morphine equivalents per day. So let's just use the EPERC Fast Fact and the Ripamani Mercadante one. And see what you guys come up with for a dose. Okay, who got one with the EPERC? What'd you guys get? Yes.
60.
Okay, so the 1,200, so you'd take 1,200 divided by 20 and get about 60. And then we would, depending on the patient, do a 25 to 50% reduction, right, based on that. Okay, what did someone get a number with the other one, with the 4,812? 100 milligrams a day, right? So big difference. So 60 or 100 with these numbers. Okay, let's do one. So let's do another one. Let's look at if the patient is on 300 oral morphine equivalents. All right, what did you guys get? With the EPERC one, what did you guys get? Okay, so 300 on the EPERC one. What's the ratio on there? I don't have it in front of me. Sorry, I'm asking. It's 5 to 1. Okay, so 300 divided by 5 gives you 60. Okay, so then what about, which is interesting, right? So you've got a patient who was on 300 oral morphine equivalents that you would give 60, and a patient who was on 1,200 that you would give 60 based on this. So this is one of the problems with the variable ratios, right? And you've got to look at your patient. And that's why I say it's important to work with one and get familiar with one and start recognizing where your issues are and when you want to adjust things. What about with the other one? What did you come up with? 37.5. Okay, so there's still some significant difference there, right? So what I will tell you is, again, you want to use one, pick one, use it, and then and figure out what the nuances are for that one. What I will tell you, so with the one, the 1,200 oral morphine equivalents, you saw that with the Ripamani one, you would get 100 milligrams of methadone per day. That's a big dose. And you think about, what if you've got somebody on 15,000 oral morphine equivalents and then your ratio is always 12 to 1, right? So I would say some protocols out there have a maximum recommended methadone dose. We actually recommend a maximum daily starting dose of 60 milligrams per day. So that's how we have altered that a little bit. So you have to monitor closely. So you have to monitor patients very, very closely. Again, every patient's going to respond very differently. You don't know where they are, that 5 hours to 130. You definitely don't want to increase more frequently than every 3 days, and really 7 days is probably optimal. And the conversion, this is one thing to absolutely know. That's why it's in yellow and some capitals too. You cannot use those ratios to go from methadone to oral morphine equivalents. They do not work. A number of protocols have been tried to publish that are out there. If you have to do that, please talk to somebody who's expert in methadone conversions and pain management. It's not well established. Again, ensuring outpatient access is extremely important. You can use methadone in relatively opioid-naive patients. You don't always have to do this conversion that we're talking about. That's less frequent, but you can start some methadone in opioid-naive patients. I would recommend starting at 2.5 milligrams. That's usually a good dose to start in an opioid-naive patient. You may sometimes push that to 5, but 2.5, I think, is a reasonable place to start when you don't have any idea how they're going to respond to opioids. I think 2.5 every 12 hours is a reasonable place to start. You may do Q8 in some patients. And then there's the consideration as the methadone as a coanalgesic, and thinking about that, maybe you don't have to do these massive conversions to methadone and starting somebody on 60 milligrams of methadone a day or 30 milligrams of methadone a day. Maybe you can start much smaller than that. Maybe if the patient is on a long-acting opioid that they got some benefit from, but you're just not getting optimal control, maybe you can use methadone as a coanalgesic to get some more benefit, pull in that neuropathic component and get some benefit from that. So you can continue the previous opioid, including the routine and the breakthrough dosing, and add methadone onto it. Again, those doses that you're thinking about more for an opioid-naive patient, using it more for those other actions. And then you can titrate it to effect. And you may even think about, after you get the patient to better pain control, thinking about bringing down the other opioid, because you may have escalated the other opioid to some extent related to opioid-induced hyperalgesia or in reaction to some of the problems that you caused with the other opioid. So you may be able to bring that other dose down. And you may eventually get to all methadone, but this is a way that you can introduce methadone with avoiding some of the side effects and some of the concerns that people have about it. So in summary, I think methadone is invaluable, but you have to be careful with using it and learning how to use it under somebody who has been using it for a while. You've got to weigh all the risks and benefits, and knowing which protocol you want to use, getting familiar with it, and if you go from one institution to another that they recommend you use another, I personally recommend doing it the way the institution recommends, but then always double-checking yourself with what you've been doing for years. And with that is it. Yes. So the question is, when you have somebody in the hospital and you're pressured to get them out and you want to get them out quickly, how do you do that rapid switch or that rapid titration? So some places don't do the rapid conversions like we talked about, the full conversion protocols. We do. We actually take patients that... We typically, when we have these high doses, patients are often on PCAs. So we will often convert people to methadone and leave them on a PRN PCA dose. I would say you need, if people are on really big doses of other opioids, you need a good 3 days to get them to a place that they can go home. But so we would use the conversion protocol, the 4-8-12. We would, if we knew we had them for 3 days, we would be a little bit aggressive with it. But again, we would typically use 60 as our maximum starting dose. So 20 Q8 is a really good maximum starting place. So we would convert them over. We would leave them on, if they were on a PCA, we'd leave them on a PCA for 24 hours, then get them to a PO plus an IV push PRN, typically the next day. Then hopefully the next day we've adjusted their PRN to the point that they, usually if we can get them to where they're needing 5 or 6 PRNs in a day, that's reasonable to send them out on, knowing that that methadone is going to continue to build and their PRNs will come down some. So we try to find an effective PRN, which is typically about 10% of what they used over the day. So sometimes we use some pretty big PRN doses initially as we transition people home. But we see a lot of post-op pain, so a lot of cancer patients that have had major resections or whatever, and so a lot of times we are having to be careful with what's the acute on chronic piece of that and how much do you convert to a chronic nature. But does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Kind of. Okay. All right.
One more question.
Yes.
What about heroin?
Okay.
Coming in who's been on heroin, mm-hmm. as an outpatient, mm-hmm. you're trying to control their pain in the hospital.
Great. That's a great question. So if you have a patient who is on heroin at home, they come into the hospital and you're trying to control their pain, it's a fabulous conundrum. The difficult thing in the U.S. is you legally can use methadone in the hospital to manage somebody. You can use any opioid, even in a patient who's addicted, in the hospital to manage their pain and keep them medically stable, including methadone or buprenorphine. You can use those. The problem is, what's your transition to home? All right. What do you do once they go home? So as long as they're institutionalized, you've got control of that, you're dispensing it to them, that's fine. But sometimes, if you've used methadone inpatient, it can actually delay their care outpatient. Because, for example, we have some addiction centers that use solely buprenorphine. They don't want to put somebody on buprenorphine that's been on methadone recently. So it can delay their outpatient substance abuse treatment. So you have to consider that outpatient conversion plan. So legally, you can do it. The conversions are difficult. Figuring out how much methadone to use is tough. Often it correlates best with how much money the patient is spending on heroin per day. So that's a good question to ask, is how much are you spending? We don't personally have an inpatient addiction group, but that would be ideal, is to have that group see them. But you have to think about what's the outpatient plan and make sure that you've got an outpatient plan in place if you're thinking about using methadone. If you cannot establish an outpatient plan for methadone continuation, I would use full agonist opioids, immediate release opioids, to treat the patient's pain while they're in the hospital until you can figure out a long-term plan. Okay. And is the patient even willing to do outpatient therapy? Okay. Any other questions? Yes?
How often do you titrate the methadone infusions?
Okay, so titrating methadone infusions, how often? So we don't use continuous infusion methadone. We do like Q8-hour IV piggyback methadone if we're doing an IV methadone. So we treat it the same as oral. We don't titrate more frequently than every few days. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we tend to think about them pretty much the same. I know there are places that use methadone PCAs. We don't, so I can't really speak to best use with that, because there is some acute analgesia that you get in that initial phase. Like I said, you can get a peak plasma effect in 2.5 to 4 hours. You can get some analgesia in that period. But overall, you know, then you're accumulating. And so the question is, if you're using it for an acute situation, what do you do if the pain gets better and the methadone's still there? Okay. Yes?
Sorry, can you expect Narcan to work in the same way since you have the other receptors on the
tube? Great question. So can you expect naloxone to work in the same way? Yes. So it's still your primary issue with respiratory depression is still going to come from the mu agonism. So it's still going to antagonize that. The big problem is naloxone only works for about an hour, whereas your methadone is going to stick around for hours and hours and hours. So you probably, if a patient has overdosed on methadone, you either are going to have to redose the naloxone, so monitoring the patient very closely and redose, or you may even need a continuous infusion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.